mouth.
Word of
mouth.
Word of
mouth.
I'm so in love with you.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we're talking about love in its many joys, forms, and complications. Love is the ultimate stage of Elizabeth Gilbert's memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. That book was a fixture on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 2 years and was adapted into a film starring Julia Roberts. Its cult following has inspired copycat tours of Indonesia, where Gilbert eventually fell in love with a Brazilian expat she calls Felipe in the book. Elizabeth Gilbert joined us for Writers on a New England Stage to discuss Committed. That was her 2011 follow-up to what she calls the freakishly successful Eat, Pray, Love. Committed is Gilbert's attempt to make peace with marriage, the institution both she and Felipe swore against after both surviving brutal divorces. We talked with Gilbert about her research on love and marriage across countries and cultures, along with some of the perks that came with Eat, Pray, Love's mega-seller status. You know, I went back and read your books in preparation for this and watched your TED Talk on YouTube, but I'm going to begin with the question that everybody really wants to know, which is, were you happy with the choice of Julia Roberts playing you in Eat, Pray, Love?
Do you know, this friend of mine said the other day, I couldn't see it, and then I saw the movie and kind of, by the end of it, I thought she was sort of looking like you, and I said, no, we want me to look like her. It's the wrong way. We don't want her. I was delighted with it, and I mean, it's hard to even know how to answer that question because it makes you sound like, yes, I thought that was perfect casting for Julia Roberts to be. It's like the biggest upgrade from coach to first class that you could ever imagine. But she's lovely, and she is the reason that movie happened. She has the power to make things like that occur, and she made it occur.
If so many people are watching your relationship, so many people were curious about what was going to happen next. I wonder how you as a writer could pull yourself away from, you know, to a safe enough distance to write unselfconsciously about your relationship.
It was tricky, and the first draft of Committed is a 500-page disaster that's under my bed in a box. And the reason that it was a disaster is because I couldn't figure out how to do that. Mm. And I think there's so many ways in which I'm lucky about when Eat, Pray, Love happened, that sort of success happened on my fourth book, not my first, because I think it would be really debilitating then, because you would just think you could never possibly write again. Mm. You know, it happened when I was closer to 40 than 20, or else I would have been getting out of limousines with no underwear without a doubt. If I had gotten famous at that age. And, you know, timing was good. But it was still hard. And I'm a pleaser. I like to make people happy. And I was faced with this question of how do you make millions of readers happy? And I tried to write a book that would. And it was so pandery and vacant, the first draft of it. And it wasn't until I narrowed down my circle of who I was writing to a handful of the women who I've known my whole life, who I'm closest to, the women who I sit and drink wine with and talk about this stuff with. And I just blocked out everybody else, and I wrote the book for them with the hope that other people are also having these conversations and there'll be something familiar and intimate in it for others as well. Yeah.
Well, a listener asked, has writing about the relationship so much changed the relationship?
I would say for the better in terms of Committed. I mean, the
because
other,
he's being watched?
those Brazilians. no, I think, actually, he's not being watched because he's such a private person, and even the changing of his name has been another layer of privacy, and I feel like he's this ballast in our relationship and hasn't sought any sort of spotlight around this and, didn't go on Oprah and didn't go even to the movie premiere, is so supportive and so loving, but just wisely said, I think it's best if one of us just holds the normal life safe. Mm-hmm. And you go out and do that and then come home. So, but actually this book, I think, helped our marriage a lot because I shudder to think that I would have entered it without doing this much thinking, and there's no way I would have done this much thinking without having written about it. And we kind of, you know, I read it to him as I was going. All the research that I was doing, I filtered through him and with him, and it's really the story of our collective attempt to make sense of this. And in this regard, I don't think there's anything particularly special about us. I think we're a pretty representative couple going into a second relationship after the failures of the first. So I think it's more like we're the avatars for everybody's questions.
But also an incredibly self-aware couple from the sounds of it. I mean, you say, even for you and Felipe, I recognize that there is always the possibility of another divorce because I love Felipe.
Yeah.
So you can choose, you can unchoose. Tell us a little bit about the cost of choice.
This is something that I think is probably the most fascinating thing I learned when I was studying the history of marriage, that when you make love the currency of marriage, divorce rates immediately skyrocket. When marriage is a business contract, people stick it out because their expectation is business deal, you know, and we can all deal with like colleagues that we don't like working with, but we can work alongside with them if that was always the idea. But in every society across human history, whenever you have taken a conservative traditional society of arranged marriage and replaced it with a modern liberal Western society of romantic marriage, the divorce rates just hit the roof, and it's happening right now in India as you watch, and people are always on hand to say, ah, people don't know how to stick it out anymore. But the reality of it is that When the contract is based on love, and when love dies, you cannot live with someone anymore. And judges recognize this, and the laws will start to change, and people will start to discuss the cruelty of making two people stay together who once loved each other and don't anymore. And I feel like divorce is the tax we pay for believing in love, or for believing that love should be linked to marriage. And it's a risk I'm willing to take, but I am so much more respectful now of what's at stake, which is a broken heart, and there's nothing more devastating than that.
Part of your research was also within your own family, speaking to your mother and your grandmother, Maud. Please tell us a little bit about her. She just sounds fabulous.
Oh, I'm lucky enough to have a 96-year-old grandmother who is lucid and brilliant. And I went and talked to her about marriage. I feel like it was important for me to really go 3D on this, to kind of go three generations deep. And I'm lucky enough to be able to do that in my family. And it was mind-blowing and eye-opening to get her to open up about her life. My grandmother was born in Minnesota during the Depression, and she was born in a blizzard, and she had a severe cleft palate deformation, and the family wasn't able to dig out and get her to surgery for, I think it was 6 months, that they fed her through a tube on this farm in 1916 and kept her alive. And she had this deformity, and she had this speech impediment, and, you know, right in the middle of the face, a great deal of scarring, and so she was incredibly insecure and had been told her whole life that she would never marry. And in that sort of insensitivity that people used to have, like, ah, yeah, she's the one who'll never marry. And the benefit of that is that she was allowed to become educated. And she was the only one in her family who finished high school while all her cousins and sisters were married at 16 and pregnant at 16 and a half. She got an education. She had a job. She had autonomy. She had her own place that she lived in her early 20s. And she had money and savings. And the story that she always told me was about this coat that she had that she bought with her savings, that was this wine-colored coat with a fur collar that she bought for like $7 or some astronomical amount of money. And it was the most beautiful thing she ever owned. And ultimately, she did end up getting married. She married my grandfather, who was a very rough farmer, and he took her out of town and put her back on an impoverished farm, and she had 8 kids and was never had anything again the rest of her life until basically 1978. And but she told me that when her first daughter was born, they had nothing for her, and so she cut up her coat and made a Christmas outfit for her daughter out of it, which is, on one hand, so inspirationally loving, and on the other hand, exactly the story of what so many women in my family and so many other people's families have done with their dreams of themselves, is that you have it for a while, and then you cut it up and sew it into something and give it away to the people who you're taking care of. And it was interesting, too, when I asked her what the happiest time in her life was, I thought she would say those single years when she was making money and living on her own, but she said those early years of marriage on the farm where they had nothing. And I said, why? And she said, because I never dreamed that anyone would marry me. And I was so happy and I was so fulfilled. And then right after that, she said to me, but now that you've met this nice man, you're not going to get married and have kids and stop writing books, are you? So there's this message of, this intergenerational, like, I'm proud of what I did. I'm proud of how I took care of these people. Don't do it. Don't cut up your wine-colored coat for anybody, is kind of what she was telling me.
But it seems like the narrative that we get is still a very sort of bifurcated sense. Like, just as her happiness inside of that marriage was very true for her, and she also didn't want you to give away your life, it seems to me the predominant story is, well, you can either choose a family or you can choose your career.
Yeah, well, we're adults here, right? There are contradictions and paradoxes.
Okay.
and it's a complicated story. And I think, at my point in my life, I've come to recognize that I can't do everything in one lifetime. And there's a sort of triage almost where I've had to choose what my essence is and what is the priority for me. And the other things, you know, that's where I start to get really kind of karmic and Hindu-y thinking just because it's convenient at that moment. And I think, I'll do it next time. You know, like everything I don't get done this time, I'll pick it up on the next round, you know. And I think, you know, Martha Beck, that wonderful writer who writes a lot in Oprah Magazine, said that she felt like, of all the women she knows that she's met, they fall into four categories. There are those who chose career over family and who feel conflicted about it. There are those who chose family over career and who feel conflicted about it. There are those who chose family and career and who feel really conflicted about it. And there are the mystics. And she defines the mystics as a woman who could be in any one of those categories but has somehow followed some deeply honest inner voice, has let go of what she can't do, and selected what she's here for, and has drowned out all the sort of buzzing chaos about everything that you're supposed to be, and is on her own path. And I would submit that it's tricky to live in a time where we all have to become mystics in order to be happy, but it is sort of the moment where we live.
Which one are you?
Well, definitely not family over career. I've worked at... I'm a mystic.
You're a mystic.
Yeah. Oh, let me just put it out there.
She just earned it.
You know, I'm a holy, holy being.
That was an excerpt of my conversation with Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the extreme bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, and Committed, A Skeptic Makes Peace with Marriage. I spoke with her as part of the Writers on a New England Stage series. That's a partnership of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. We posted a link to the full interview with Elizabeth Gilbert at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, falling in love with a robot. It sounds so easy after all this messy human stuff. We'll gear up for a different kind of romance when Word of Mouth continues after the break.